Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball, host of Milk Street Radio. If you'd like to change the way you cook and also think about food, please check out the Milk Street podcast. We travel around the world to find pizza in Tokyo, Egyptian food in Berlin, and Bhutanese farmers in Vermont. We speak to Jamie Oliver, Rachel Ray, Al Roker, Ina Garten, as well as Michael Twitty, Marcus Samuelson, and Alice Waters. And we'll introduce you to recipes that will change the way you cook, from bright pink Tottenham cake to Afghan dumplings to shoyu sugar steak, and that one is direct from Hawaii. It's a whole new world of food right here on Milk Street Radio. Please check us out on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts, or go to 177milkstreet.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, welcome, Books of the Year. It's our Q&A bonus episode where we take an author through our rigorous but formally set out questions. David McCloskey's book is Damascus Station. You're going to hear us talking about that, precisely where you got this podcast from. But these are the Q&A. David, it's now 7:15 in the morning. You're in Texas, so you're on to your eighth coffee. So let's get on with this.
You're not far off. Okay. You're not far off.
All right. So question number one, what is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading?
Okay, that's an easy one because it's the one that I just finished a few days ago. Michael Chabon, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. It is a highly ambitious novel. So he got the Pulitzer, I believe, for writing a book called The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And The Yiddish Policeman's Union is one part kind of crime noir, one part speculative history. It essentially follows the adventures of a Jewish investigator in Alaska. And the whole premise of the book is that rather than the Jewish homeland having been established in Israel-Palestine after the war, it was established in Alaska. And so the whole kind of state of Israel is up in Alaska. And it sounds like an insane book, and in some respects it is, but it is a beautifully written crime story, but also this kind of exploration of alienation and loss and identity. And I just thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it.
I read that years, because that's not a new book, is it? That came out a while back. But
No, it's not new. I don't know when it came out, but it's definitely not
that's
new.
As an idea, that's the most adventurous idea for a crime novel, I think. Okay, so that's Michael Chabon's The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Where do you enjoy writing the most, David? And is there a specific time of day? I mean, we can see in the background behind you, drawn curtains and a very dark room. It seems perfect for talking to a former CIA man, to be honest.
That's right.
Is it where you're sat now? Is that where you would do the bulk of your writing?
No, I do almost all of it. So I'm actually in my bedroom right now. I've got three children under the age of 7, and so they're out getting breakfast in the main area. I do almost all of my writing at coffee shops, and it's very loud. And I, for whatever reason, find that to really work for me. So I sit at the same coffee shop pretty much every day. I get the same thing. I sit down at the same time. That's where I do almost all my work. There's one exception, which is one week a year, as I'm pushing toward the final third of a book, I'll disappear and go to a house in a town outside Marfa here in southern Texas near the Mexican border. And I'll sit there for a week and finish the book. And that's probably my happy place, because I'll write for about 16, 17 hours a day for 4 days straight until it's done and just comes out. But it's either that or the coffee shop, one of those two.
That is amazing. I don't think we've ever had anyone answer as the coffee shop before. That is amazing.
16 to 17 hours a day? What? This is incredibly depressing.
I love it. It's the one of my best weeks of the year. I get up at 5:30 and I start writing, and I don't end until the you know, the evening of that day, I get into a zone. It's important that you do it at the right part in the book, because if you do it too early, you're going to end up writing a whole bunch of stuff. At least for me, I don't keep, but if I do it toward the back third, I'll usually get about 40 to 45,000 words done in about 3.5 or 4 days.
Wow. I'm already fed up with speaking to you, because that's exactly not what I want to hear. I'm going to change this next question to something else based because of what you just said. When we spoke to Lee Child on this podcast a number of times, he famously basically lives off coffee and dope. Yeah. And he kind of doesn't eat anything at all. But he has a phenomenal coffee intake. I can't remember quite
it's
how many.
It's ridiculous. It's like it's in the teens.
There's
the
20 pots of coffee. Yeah. You know, he starts with a brand new document in a laptop that's only got one document, and he just drinks coffee. So based on that discipline, which you have just described, which is superhuman, unreal, and so on, what sustains you then when you're going through one of those amazing superhuman writing efforts?
So it actually is a very specific diet for that week. So it's probably 8 to 10 cups of coffee a day, something like that. Like just constantly. It's a lot of mineral water. There's a brand called Topo Chico that's found in the kind of the southwestern United States that I really enjoy. So I have that. I have eggs and sausage and salsa in the morning. I have salami and cheese, like just a few bites of it for lunch to give me something. I usually have some peanuts in the afternoon. And then what typically happens is I'm pretty hungry by the end of the day. So I'll get to this hotel in town that stays open until about midnight. I'll get there at sometime around 11 and I eat an entire pepperoni pizza and I have one scotch. And then I go back and go to bed and I do it all over again in the morning.
Wow. The menu of champions.
I was going to say.
Well, you've heard it. Anyway, works
I'm a little
David.
Less daunted now with the pepperoni pizza and whiskey. Goodness me. When David, did you last visit a library?
About 5 days ago, 6 days ago. Something like that.
And is that for work or what? Why would you be at the library?
I guess it could be one of two reasons. Work, so books for research, or children's books to read to my kids. Those are the two things I go for, yeah.
When you're reading to your children, do you do all the voices? That's not my question.
Sometimes. It maybe depends a little bit on how many gin and tonics I've had that evening, wow, whether I get too carried away with the voices. But I do try to read out loud to them every night and have found it, you know, to be a lot of fun to kind of get them excited about story too. So I generally try to do the voices, make it feel fun.
Now, on the cover of the book, Matt mentioned in our previous podcast the quote from General David Petraeus. There's also a quote from a top historian and author, Simon Sebag Montefiore, who says, breathlessly gripping and truly terrifying. He's also sent us a question in the form of a voice note, and he's a fan of yours. So here's the question from Simon Sebag Montefiore.
Hi, David. This is Simon Sebag Montefiore. I just love the book. I think it's the best spy thriller of the year. And I'd like to know, were the cases of CIA agents having affairs with Syrian agents on the ground in Syria or in other parts of the Arab world? What would happen to them if they did?
There you go.
So that's a great question. And the reality is that they would be pretty much terminated immediately from employment with the Central Intelligence Agency, which doesn't make my, you know, doesn't really improve my novel. And so I decided to change things a little bit in the book, of course. But, you know, the reality of that, even though it's, again, it's pretty common in spy fiction to have a relationship between handler and asset, inside CIA, it is essentially a cardinal sin. Like you're gone. The reason for that is because, well, it's really a couple reasons. One is it's a tremendous lapse in judgment, and really all CIA has, and I think I have some characters, Proctor says it in the book, you know, all she has at the end is their judgment, right? And whether she can trust them. You know, and then the other thing is you can't trust anything that's coming out of that asset's mouth if the handler is romantically involved with them, you know. There's this balance of needing to have that intimacy and trust with the asset, but also the ability to handle them, to control them in some respects, in order to understand if the information that they're providing is accurate, and if the handler is sort of, you know, foggy because they're in love with the asset or in lust with the asset, you can never trust it. And so it's really the kind of thing that gets you pushed out immediately and really without much pomp and circumstance.
David, you mentioned in the previous podcast that you were recruited to the CIA when you were still an undergrad. So the question I'd like to ask is, what path in that sort of parallel universe where you didn't get recruited by the CIA, what would David McCluskey be doing now? What were you always wanting to be in the CIA, or were you actually heading somewhere else when you were recruited?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually hard for me to even remember back to that time, because it was, you know, it was middle of undergrad and all of my thoughts about what I wanted to do were just forming. I will say, though, that something that I wanted to do, and it's been kind of fun to see that, even though it's not precisely the same, that I'm kind of moving or have moved to something similar, is I wanted to be a screenwriter. And I had that thought as kind of I wasn't doing a whole lot to make it happen, obviously, but I had that thought of it would be really fun in kind of a fantasy world to do that. And then I went to the CIA and, you know, life became life. But that, if I were to identify something in that interim, you know, that period back in those misty days, that would be it, screenwriter.
So you're writing the screenplay for Damascus Station then, yes?
I don't think I am. You know, it's funny, writing a 400-page novel seems less daunting to me than writing like a 100-page screenplay, because I just, when I'm writing the novel, I can kind of get in there and I am the one who's creating everything. And because I've never written one, my understanding is, you know, you're sort of creating the recipe for something that a team of people will end up creating: the cinematography, the costume, you know, the actors, the director. The novel, I can be all of that, which I find easier in my head than trying to write the screenplay, which seems more daunting.
Do you have a favorite spy novel?
Yes. The Little Drummer Girl by John le Carré. That is far and away my favorite. I read that as a high schooler. I've reread it multiple times since, and I just love how well he treats the relationship between Charlie and Gedi Becker, this sort of handler asset relationship, and I explore it in my novel as well. I love that. And obviously, looking at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Middle East roots there, I just find that book to be enchanting. I love it.
You've mentioned, David, that you're writing your second novel right now. Is there anything that you've taken from your experience of writing the first one that you're putting into practice now? Any sort of little tips, any lessons that you learned from writing the first one?
Well, it's funny. I thought when I started the process on book two that it would be easier because, hey, I've already written one, you know, just get this production line going and it'll be 30% easier. Completely false. I think that, you know, I would say the lessons have become more clear to me as I've started writing and in midstream in the third book. But for the second book, it was deeply painful, actually. I think that a lot of my lessons from, or my, you know, the things that I thought I had learned on the first book, when I applied them to the second, didn't quite work. And there's a whole bunch of different reasons for that, I think. But the process was harder. It felt like there's a process. I think of it in my mind as an archaeological dig. You're uncovering this thing. It already exists, but you're uncovering this thing, you know, and you're having to do really hard spade work at times. And then other times there's fine kind of brushing. And for whatever reason on book two, it's felt like I've had to do a lot more digging to get the thing out. So the lessons have been few and far in between, but I think, you know, or the learning rather has been few and far in between the two books. But I think, and I'm hopeful that, you know, just by continuing, the single biggest one is sometimes you just keep digging and keep working until you know the thing is as good as it can be. And if you stop at any point before that, or if you think there's any shortcut, that's completely false. Because I've become to the kind of belief that especially when you're just creating something or facilitating this creative process from whole cloth, oftentimes you have to create like 20 versions of the thing or 10 versions of the thing to really understand what works. And if you try to shortcut that process, you'll end up with something that's not the full potential of what it could be.
Final question, David McCloskey. Bearing in mind, and the answer to this question will be yes or no, okay? That's it, just yes or no. And I think the answer is going to be no.
Just like a poly. This is just like a poly. Yeah. Yes or no, yeah.
That's perfect. I'm very comfortable
okay.
with this question.
Bearing in mind all the forms that you had to sign before you were allowed to leave the CIA, bearing in mind that you were a senior analyst for the CIA, given that you advised President Obama, would you be allowed to answer this question? Do you think President Obama should have stuck to his red lines? Can you answer that question, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Well, and in which case, therefore, what is the answer then?
I do think he should have stuck to the red line. I think that the original sin of our Syria policy was this feeling or assessment on the part of a lot of people on his foreign policy team. And I don't envy the task that they had, but they just thought that Assad would fall. There was this sort of historical inevitability to it, given what was going on in the region. And as a result, you know, if you believe it's inevitable and we don't have to do anything, you end up in a world where your military policy becomes divorced from your strategic communications and your rhetoric, because you start to say things like, oh, he should step aside, or, you know, there's a red line on the use of chemical weapons, and you don't that you'll actually have to do anything because Assad's demise is assured. And that was completely wrong. And so what happened was we ended up with a tremendous gap between our words and our actions and our ability to resource those actions. And I think that we just got completely over our skis, and we ended up really creating a ton of confusion on the part of our, you know, Syrian partners and on the part of our friends in the region about what we were actually going to do. That to me is that was a tremendous mistake. And I think that what we should have done, there's a sort of an idea that somehow if we enforce the red line, we had to invade Syria, or is it? No. I think that we should have sent a strong message to the Assad regime that we weren't going to tolerate the use of those weapons because of what we'd said. And we could have done that with airstrikes. We could have done that with missiles. We could have done things to create, you know, consequences for those actions. And I think at minimum, we should have done that, if for no other reason. Might not have affected the strategic balance of the war, but it would have made it clear that we actually stand by the rhetoric that we espouse, and we're willing to resource, you know, a policy that is in line with our rhetoric. And we should have at minimum done that.
David McCloskey, fascinating to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed. I think the sun is probably up in Texas. It's time for you to go and have a pizza and a scotch or something like that. But a pleasure to speak to you. We look forward to speaking to you on your next book. And thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it, guys.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball, host of Milk Street Radio. If you'd like to change the way you cook and also think about food, please check out the Milk Street podcast. We travel around the world to find pizza in Tokyo, Egyptian food in Berlin, and Bhutanese farmers in Vermont. We speak to Jamie Oliver, Rachel Ray, Al Roker, Ina Garten, as well as Michael Twitty, Marcus Samuelson, and Alice Waters. And we'll introduce you to recipes that will change the way you cook, from bright pink Tottenham cake to Afghan dumplings to shoyu sugar steak, and that one is direct from Hawaii. It's a whole new world of food right here on Milk Street Radio. Please check us out on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts, or go to 177milkstreet.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.